The title of the talk tonight, it's a bit enigmatic, is We Need to Love the Garden, Not Just the Gate. And we're coming to the end of the retreat, and we learnt a lot of things in this retreat that needed to be done. Namely, we learned practice, and then we came into the meditation hall and practiced, and then we got some guidance or some method, and then we practiced. And there is the sense that the way we know if it's working or not, what we're doing here, is by checking on what we experience in the meditation, for example, and a lot of discussions and dialogue and the groups and the one-to-ones are about, well, I experienced this or the other. Is it in the right direction? Is it a right method? Is it the right way, and is it a positive experience, and where do I go next? And this is very natural to sort of ask, am I doing it right? And we have also qualities like calmness and joy, so we tend to say, you know, if I have joy, it's working. If I don't have joy, there's something wrong. And if I have calm, if I'm calm, then I'm following instructions, and if the hindrances arise, then I'm not doing it right. And the teachers have quite a hard job to say, actually the hindrances show you that you're doing it right. If restlessness arises, that's exactly what ought to arise right now. What something is ready for the restlessness to arise, and that's your meditation, and also the result of your meditation. So it asks us to look at what are the outcomes and how we measure if we're getting on, how we measure success in inverted commas. I don't like the word. But how we measure. And we have a tendency to measure through experience. But this retreat especially emphasizes cultivation, bhavana, and cultivation of qualities. And we're talking about qualities like the calm, like joy, like inner peace, and steadiness, and patience, and also kindness. And when we're talking about qualities, we're actually talking about making shift in our personality. Because the experiences come and go, and they're very unreliable as a way of looking at our spiritual journey. But qualities, meanwhile, are being developed. And what happens is we become different. We become the qualities that we're trying to develop. Something in us shifts. And so this is beyond experience and beyond technique. In the Anapanasati Sutta and in the Satipatthana Sutta, it's really clearly expressed. What happens if you do this right? Well, what happens is qualities arise which become your nature. And it's those qualities which are the ground of awakening. not the particular experiences you have, even though they might seem sometimes amazing explosions and fireworks, and sometimes boring, difficult struggle all uphill. But that's not the point. The point is, what is being developed, bit by bit, steadily, whatever your experiences are. Sometimes, by the way, you can have a really difficult time, but actually on the level of qualities or your being, that's really the best thing that could happen to you. And someone else having sabbatha, sitting, wonderful retreat. You have a good retreat? Yeah, fantastic retreat. Really good. Enjoy myself. Very peaceful, very lovely, good sangha, good food, and so on. And meanwhile, someone that's really having a hard time, something has shifted in them, which is irreversible. Which is irreversible. So in the Anapanasati Sutta, it's really clearly expressed. What is the result of practice? It's the development and fulfillment of the factors of awakening. These factors of awakening are qualities, are abilities, are shifts in the powers that we have. Mindfulness, ability to inquire, investigate, explore. The quality of balanced energy, not too much, not too little. Steadiness. The quality of happiness and joy, shalva. Calmness, concentration, equanimity. These are the factors. You don't have to remember them, or you can look at in the sutta and you'll find them. But it's just that there is the way that we can see the fruits of what we're practicing, rather than having expecting certain experiences and measuring ourselves according to them. And the qualities tell us that we can't actually design our awakening. We can't kind of set up and design awakening, because it's the self, the me, that tries to do that. And the me wants certain experiences, and the me wants freedom. But actually, what awakens is a bunch of qualities. So when the qualities shift, the qualities awaken, not the person or the ego or the self. So in a way, we are a bunch of qualities, echuyot, that change. And those qualities are awakening. They awaken. For example, the Buddha said, why is joyful important? Because joy is one of the best equipments of the mind. It's an equipment. It's not just pleasant. It's actually tools for the journey. And so it's good to ask us, to ask ourselves and reflect on this issue of qualities, because these are also the kinds of shifts that happen that we take home with us at the end of a retreat. And everything changes, we go back to Tel Aviv and we think, well, it's all gone. It was all a big bubble. A kind of cloud land, an ideal land of the angels. An angel land here, and I had peace and concentration, and now I'm back in Tel Aviv and it's all come back to zero. And of course it hasn't come back to zero. What happens is that something has shifted. We may not know it. And that's what we take out from here. There is an interesting kind of mythological story about this, or mythological text, which is the Jataka tales. These are the folk tales of the Buddhist world. And they're told to children, and actually there's a book in Israel, come out in Hebrew, called The Buddha at Bedtime, which are Jataka tales. And I read them when my grandchildren come over and stay with us. I read them every time they go to bed. So they rush to bed shouting, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. But they really like the stories. And what's interesting about the Jataka tales is they're folk tales about birds and animals, and these are represented as the rebirths of the Buddha on the way to becoming the Buddha. And each story is about the development of a quality in this particular animal, like an animal that learnt generosity by acting with generosity to save other animals, for example. So the stories are about rebirths of the Buddha who came into a body in order to learn a certain quality. And these are the paramis, the 10 paramis. They are qualities. What's interesting, they're taken in a folk way, in a storytelling way, but we can reflect that in a way, we are keeping on getting reborn in order to learn these qualities. That we almost like go back to school every retreat. Every retreat we go back to school, we go back to kindergarten, because we didn't quite learn it on the retreat before. So we need to kind of do another retreat in order to learn this quality, be reborn again in a retreat, so that we can develop qualities or the paramis. So the whole journey is developing. The paramis are personality qualities, how shifts in the personality to create patience or joy or calm or metta, love, or different 10 of them, in classically energy, etc., determination. But I like the image. We go back to school. We all the time learning to shift the personality, to free up the personality as a ground of awakening. But we are very, very, we generally find it really difficult to measure ourselves, even to measure the qualities. I mean, I hear it again and again. I've gone on so many retreats, and why is it that I have so much anger? And I've been on so many retreats and I still get angry. And why? And maybe I'm not doing it right, or maybe I should go off and do something else, or maybe it's not working for me. And it just is a sense that the self is rather bad at measuring where it is, because it's always biased. It's always got an agenda. So where the self says, I've still got anger, it's the pain of the anger that's in a way right rubbing out all the other changes that have happened to the person, which can be huge changes compared to years before practice. But they're all forgotten, because you look and you say, oh, I'm angry again. Someone else, by the way, is much better. Other people are much better at looking at you and saying, wow, you've changed. And you think you're an angry person. I think you're the most calming, gentle person I ever met. And you think you're angry. you know, it's because we are looking at things from the inside. And from the inside, we don't look, we can't really have an overview of who we are. It's really hard. We're subjective. We're biased. We've got filters and colors, how we look at ourselves all the time. We need to get a little familiar with the Dharma as nutrition, as feeding, not as experiences. And it's a model or it's a language that is right through the Dharma. What is it that we feed? It's like we're much, it's much more language of we need to fertilize the garden and then things grow. We need to give the right food, the right water, the right ecology, the right care, and then things will grow by themselves. And as I said before, we don't grow a big plant by pulling it. We grow a big plant by feeding it. And that's a model which is much more respectful to the human being, and talks about shift in the qualities, shift in the personality, shift in who we are. I think that with this in mind, I'd like to take a few minutes to examine mindfulness. Because if we take this nutritional view that is very strong in the Dharma, then it a little bit shifts the way we look at mindfulness. We've been practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness is a big word today. The sutta we're practicing is called Anapanasati Sutta. Sati is mindfulness. The Satipatthana Sutta is the four foundations for mindfulness. So sati is there as the heading in the sutta, and we are in a way practicing mindfulness. But I'd like to expand that understanding of mindfulness to include a more nutritional approach. It's certainly very big. A very big new movement in the world, mindfulness, today. I was just in communication with some people in the UK, and we were trying to initiate something in the parliament in Israel, some mindfulness in the Israeli parliament, because in the British parliament there's more than 100, I think it's more than 100 members of parliament that have gone through mindfulness courses. And in the European Union Parliament in Brussels and in the Dutch Parliament and so on, it's really, really taking a root in the Western world, mindfulness. And personally I'm delighted. Many, many years ago, the dominant form of meditation in the Western world was TM, Transcendental Meditation. And all through the 70s, 80s, 90s, if you talked about meditation, it was just TM, Transcendental Meditation. And it left a lot to be desired, to say the least. To pay a huge amount of money for someone to give you a word that you have to then repeat like a parrot, and maybe the result of that was some calmness. And you spent a lot of money. And I have a scientific background, and I looked at the literature very carefully. There were hundreds of scientific papers published by the Transcendental Meditation world on the results of transcendental meditation. And there wasn't one that was able to show that the results were any better than relaxation. All of them, the whole literature at the time, wasn't able to show that TM was better than meditation than just relaxation. And I also have a rather amusing story. In 1975, when I was in Varanasi, and I was teaching in the Banaras Hindu University, and one day the Maharishi Mahashyogi, who was the founder of transcendental meditation, he came to visit in the university, and he came to give a talk. And he came in with lots and lots of equipment, and eight or nine, and it was May in Varanasi, like really, really hot. This is nothing. What we've been experiencing now is nothing compared to May in Varanasi. And so everyone was, you know, it's hot, and we were in a big hall in the university, and he was there, and there was like eight or nine helpers who were all Europeans dressed in black suits with ties and black jackets, all fussing around him with equipment and recording and so on and so on and so on. So he started to talk, and mostly his talk consisted of giggling. He just sat there and giggled most of the time. Giggling means just laughing. What do you call it? Yeah, that's what he was doing most of the time. But at the back of the hall where I was, there was a bunch of sadhus that had come there to listen. And they were sadhus of Varanasi, you know, with matted hair and no clothes and lots of beads and kind of wild guys. And they were falling over themselves with laughter. They were crazy. They were laughing and slapping their legs and slapping each other and whoa, they were dancing around and in hysterics. And I asked them through a friend of mine, Bhaskar, who is half a sadhu but a British one, what are they laughing at? And they said, well, we know this guy, Maharishi. He was used to be one of us in Allahabad, I think. And he was totally useless. He didn't know the first thing. He was a joke. So in the end, he went off. He couldn't manage to stay in Allahabad by the Ganga. So he went off to America to sell the knowledge that we gave him. And so they said, he's a total failure. So, TM stories. So, I want to a little bit look at mindfulness again and look at it from the point of view of the nutritional model. That is, mindfulness not as a technique, but as something that we are, that feeds us a different way of being. And here I think sometimes the mindfulness in the Western world, as it is now, loses that approach. It is technique-oriented, and it's okay as a gateway, but what about the garden? And I'll give you some examples. In the text, mindfulness is really connected with or close to a word called appamada. Appamada, I think it is. Yeah, appamada. And this is close to mindfulness, but is not the same as mindfulness that is taught. Goes beyond there. The old word that's used, the English word that's used in translation is to be heedful. And heedful, never mind the word, it really means to be careful, watchful, responsible, sensitive in your actions in life. And the Buddha said, this quality, apamada, is like the elephant's footprint. Because all the other qualities of the practice are like the animal's footprint that fits inside the elephant's footprint. Its elephant footprint is so big. Anyway, it's so big that all the footprints of all the other animals fit inside. So, like the elephant's footprint, apamada, the sense of being watchful, careful, and responsible is key. And the Buddha said a few times, it's the best of the dharmas. In fact, when the Buddha died, his final words were practice apamada, watchfulness, care, responsibility, practice keenly or with diligence. They're all compounded things are impermanent. Practice apamada. And so it's got a very kind of important aspect, and it is about essentially relationship and responsibility. It's not just a technique of looking at or observing, which is often, I think, stripped down in the Western model too small. Sati is often combined with another word, sampajana. Sampajana and sati go together. And sampajana is the context of something that we're looking at. So we're looking at a thought, and sampajana is about the sources of the thought, where it goes, what might have created it, what's the global picture, the fact that a thought is arising and passing, what's the context of this thought, or what's the context of this breath? What's the bigger picture around this breath? So the sati, the mindfulness, will pick up the breath and hold it in attention, and sampajana is able to look at the bigger picture. And then there is another movement offering this whole moment of experience, watching the breath, sati, seeing the context of the breath, where it's come from, how it's come from, how it goes, where it goes, what it does to you, etc., all of that, the bigger picture, and all of that is offered to wisdom, which is described as yoniso manikaram, which is a female quality. It's the intuitive wisdom that comes when we both look at and see the bigger picture of something like the breath, or like a thought, or like a feeling. It's the wisdom that comes from that, including the Four Noble Truths, the suffering elements, and many other things, the insights that come. So that's all inside sati. It's part of sati. There, you can't imagine mindfulness without some of these other qualities. So I'm just giving it to you as an example to kind of get beyond the sense of technique here, and beyond the sense of the narrowness of technique, and expand it, and showing that it's expanded in bringing qualities and the nutrition, and of course it leads to ethics. Responsibility leads to right action. How do we know the difference between a helpful and a beneficial action, or not a helpful action? Through apamada, through sensitivity, through awareness, through watching who we are, through sense of responsibility, through a conscience, matsbun. It's all part of it. The fourth of the tetrads in the Anapanasati Sutta, and the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is called Dhamma. mindfulness of Dhamma. Mindfulness of Dhamma is about mindfulness of the truth of things. It's being aware of the Four Noble Truths inside the moment, knowing the pain, the dukkha of this moment, of something that arises, knowing the way it dissolves, knowing the space and the freedom that arises when it is dissolved. It's the whole world of insight, the whole world of wisdom. And it is built on those qualities. Those qualities bring us to a place where we can see inside our experience more deeply, more effectively, more helpfully. And I have a beautiful line from poet Wordsworth who describes this, just what we've been doing. He said, "With an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things. With an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things." So it's a beautiful, short, evocative description of just what we've been doing. The quiet, in other words, an eye made quiet with the quality of calmness, with the quality of harmony, sattva, harmony, with the power of joy, we can see. The seeing, that is a liberated seeing, we see into the life of things because the qualities are building in us that allow us to do this. So, this is why the title of the talk, "The Gate is Just the Techniques. The garden is what's growing." And we need to pay a lot of attention to what's growing in the garden. Go through the gate into the garden. And there's one other aspect that's worth mentioning. The garden is actually already a magic garden. There's something in us that is not just development of qualities, but uncovering qualities that we already have and that we may not notice so much because they're kind of covered by the trials and pains and difficulties of kind of becoming an adult in this world. The struggle of growing up in this world. And slowly, slowly, some of those divine qualities we already have in us tend to get covered over. But it really is, we can't develop qualities like calm and joy and peace and balance and harmony and insight if they weren't there already. We wouldn't know where to look for them. And so, I will also encourage a view of the garden, which is that it already is a magic garden in us. The interesting story, when the Buddha had a period of struggle in his own journey, a deep struggle, and all of a sudden he remembered that when he was a boy, he was sitting under a tree. His father was busy with agriculture. And he was under this tree and he had what you might call an enlightenment experience. It was just an experience of dissolving in the totality, being with everything. And he remembered that experience and he understood that, and it's discussed in the suttas. He understood that if that experience was possible for him when he was like 10 years old, then it's already in him. It's not something that he has to develop from scratch and struggle and fight and just go on long journey climbing the mountain to try and develop these qualities. So, yes, we need to do something. We need to have intention. We need to respect qualities. We need to develop these qualities in us. We need to have a nutritional attitude to feed those qualities. But they're already in us. So part of what we're doing is simply noticing what's already there. It's like when our back is hurting, we don't notice how nice our hands feel. They're just fine. Look, they're just really happy. Like we were doing the other night. Yeah, my hands are happy. We just forgot. It's worthwhile just having this sense of a dialogue in us between something to be done, namely, there is a journey to be travelled, and nothing to be done, because perfection is already there. Uncovering and developing. And in a way, it's still a nutritional attitude. What we feed the plant is already there, but it just needs good food to grow. This attitude is not an attitude of blame, or an attitude of too much struggle, or an attitude that it's beyond me, or an attitude that I've just got to climb and climb and climb and reach and succeed and it's both. It's a dialogue between them. Between perfection, if you like, and imperfection, or between samsara and nibbana, dialogue. And it's just worth remembering that. It's a mystery. It's not linear. It's not something that you can give a kind of a linear description or a causative view. But it's somewhere there, it's worth remembering that we are a mixture of both. And I like this I'll finish with a small poem from Rumi. He said, I was knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking on the door to heaven. After a long, long time, the door opened, but I found that I was already on the inside. Thank you.